Dan Davis. I'm the author of Lying for Money, How Famous Frauds Teach Us About the Workings of the World. Before I wrote books, I used to be an investment banker for 15 years, and I had a front seat at some of these frauds while they were being committed. So I've written a book about these experiences and what they might teach us about how the world and how a modern economy really works.
And I suppose to kick off then, what is it that it teaches us? Is this a book for people training to be fraudsters, or is there something that that perhaps a legitimate business person can learn?
It was not intentionally written as a book for people training to be fraudsters, but if you really want to commit a fraud, there's enough information in there to teach it. It's the interesting thing, though, and what does teach us about the world is that it's quite surprising why there isn't a lot more of it, because in many cases it's really easy to commit a crime of dishonesty in the corporate world. It's really difficult to prosecute one if you get found out. And if you do get found out and prosecuted, it's surprisingly lenient in the way that society punishes it. But actually, all of those things do tell us quite a lot about how the world works. The fact is that we now live in a world where everything is too complicated for any one human being to hold it in their mind all at once. You know, this is pretty new, actually. It's something that developed with modern capitalism, maybe at the end of the 18th century, which is why nearly all of my examples are from the early Victorian period or later. Because one person can't keep everything in their whole mind, we invent systems to economise on the amount of attention we have to pay things, so literally to make things manageable. And every time you decide what you're going to check up on, you are implicitly deciding what you're not going to check up on. And that's where the fraud gets into the system. The way I kind of think about it is that economists study trust and the building blocks of business by looking at healthy companies. But that might be the wrong way to do it. You know, doctors don't learn about the human body by studying healthy people. You learn a lot about how the system works by looking at the funny pathological cases where it all breaks down.
Does that mean then that there is a perfect system out there that has no fraud in it whatsoever? And would that actually be a good system to be aiming for?
There might be an economy out there with no fraud, but it's probably a very small Polynesian island or something. One of the interesting things, actually, that I found when researching this book is if you're thinking about cases of classic commercial fraud, business to business, places like Nigeria and Greece have very low levels of that. They have huge amounts of government corruption. They have a lot of individual crimes of dishonesty, but they don't have much business crime because in places like that, it's such a low trust system that you don't do business with anyone that you don't know. If you look, on the other hand, at the ultimate high trust economy, somewhere like Canada, Canada has a frighteningly high rate of securities fraud. One of its stock exchanges got closed down because it was gaining the nickname the scam capital of the world.
Which no exchange wants.
It was giving a bad name to the other Canadian exchanges, which were themselves pretty rife with mining fraud promotions. But the reason for that is that the overall culture in Canada is so honest that there's very little defence against fraudsters. One of the things that I think is one of the big messages of the book is that the economy isn't set up to solve the problem of how do you guard yourself against fraud. It's set up to solve the problem of do you want to be rich. And in a lot of cases, investors don't want to be protected from fraud. They want to invest. In the 1860s and 70s, when the London Stock Exchange was just getting going, it's reasonably credibly estimated that one in six companies floated on that exchange was a fraud.
Oh, that's an enormous sum.
It was. And of the remaining 5/6, they were by no means all perfect. There was a lot of them that were companies that weren't exactly frauds, but which were in such shape they should never have been sold to the public.
But, I mean, you'd think that people would have stepped in and said, well, you know, how can I trust where I'm putting my money at all? You think people would be pulling their cash out?
Well, they eventually did 40 years later. But the thing is that if we look back to the 1860s and 70s, lots of people got really rich at that point. There were lots and lots of railway frauds, and those were massive in Victorian eras. But there were also genuine railways being built. So what I'm kind of saying is that the question of protecting yourself against fraud is quite a complicated one, because it's really an economic one rather than a criminal justice problem, because the optimum amount of fraud in your system is never zero, and it could be quite high. If you're spending all your time protecting yourself against fraud, then firstly, it's a costly thing to do because you're wasting time on the controls themselves. But the real cost of constantly being on the alert to protect yourself from fraud is the number of things that never get done at all.
One of the record-breaking frauds is back in the headlines this week with PPI. So a court ruling has said that the amount of compensation potentially available to victims has gone up by another $18 billion. Won't go into the details of why exactly, but this was this huge fraud that nobody ever went to jail for.
Well, the interesting thing here is that it was a fraud with no real overall controlling mind. This is one of the ones that I had a front seat for. And the thing that I kind of rather shamefacedly have to admit in the book is that I saw PPI being growing up into a massive thing. It was entirely my job to look at the UK banking system at that time. I knew it was a terrible product. I knew it was probably being missold, but I never quite understood how big it was, and I never quite understood that what was going on was a fraud, because there are huge psychological barriers to standing up, pointing at what were at the time some of the biggest and most successful businesses in Britain, and saying, actually, this guy's a criminal. You know, I had a combative relationship with Fred Goodwin, and we said some mean things about each other in public meetings at the time, but I don't think we ever got to the stage of accusing each other of defrauding the public. But the thing was, nobody actually committed a fraud here, or rather, the people who committed a fraud were people who it's really unattractive to prosecute. They were the people in the branches. They didn't get rich out of doing it. They are not, in general, unpleasant people. Whereas you've got people in head office who did get rich out of the PPI scandal and who, in many cases, well, were made to look extremely unattractive, but they've not really committed a crime, because what happened in the PPI scandal is no one gave the order to go out and missell sort of however many hundreds of billions of PPI. They just invented a bad product and gave very, very tough sales targets and incentives. And in many ways, the fraud went off and committed itself. And the thing is that now you've got a situation where millions of people have been ripped off for billions of pounds, but no one seems to have committed an actual prosecutable offence. Can you think of anything that's more likely to undermine confidence in the overall system?
You mentioned the sort of almost the not being able to see the wood for the trees elements, that a fraud, a crime can be so big that you can't even see that it's a crime. Throughout the book, I was aware that often these are crimes of psychology, that they're to do with, you know, playing on just, you know, the weaknesses of us as, you know, human beings. It keeps coming back time and time again.
Yeah, well, they are literally white-collar crimes. And that phrase is interesting, because how many other crimes are defined not by the act itself, but by the type of person who commits it? And a white-collar crime, it's a sociological thing. The sociologists have a lot more understanding of them than either the economists or the law enforcers do, which is that a guy wearing a suit in a white collar, your default position is to trust him. You know, and that's not saying anything particularly bad about society. You know, as I say, Canada is a really high trust economy with loads of frauds. If you're going to be a prosperous place where everyone does business with strangers, then you have to be a place where people's default assumption is that someone in a business setting representing themselves as a professional is someone that you can trust. The trouble is that we can't pay attention to every single detail, and so it takes quite a lot of really blatant dishonesty, or it takes some cataclysmic effect like a bill that really, literally can't be paid and a sum of cash that isn't transferred when someone specifically promised it would be before you realise that you're dealing with a wrong'un. Even then, people get second chances. They get too many second chances.
This was going to be my point, that the same filter which makes us trust people in suits in a fraud setting also helps in the courts.
This is one thing where people actually could help themselves a lot. The book has something like 25, 26 different histories and case studies of famous and often hilarious frauds. In very few of those cases was it a first offence. Lots of the people in there had not only committed a fraud before, they'd actually been tried and in many cases served jail time for a fraud exactly similar to the really big one that got them in the book. I don't know why people do this. It really is very clear that the reason most of us don't commit crimes of dishonesty, even though we could every single day, is that we've got a strong psychological defence mechanism against lying. Fraudsters are different from us in that they've broken down that social and psychological mechanism, and once that is gone, it's gone, and they will regularly come back to the well again and again and again. But because we're nice people and we're a trusting place, we always say to people, you know, shouldn't we give him another chance? Do we want to destroy someone's career over one mistake? Whereas in most cases, the answer is yes, we do want to, or at least we want him to have a career that doesn't involve being put in a position of trust, because it wasn't a mistake, it was a lie. And once someone has demonstrated that they're capable of lying, usually they're always going to go back to the well, because it's easier than telling the truth and it's more profitable. I'm sounding kind of moralistic here, but it's actually quite an important point of economics in my view.
I mean, are there lessons that you think should actually be learned here? I mean, that clearly is one, that we should just assume that people who have committed fraud are going to do so again.
Yeah, you know, which isn't to say they can never, they have to be outcasts from society. It's just that they shouldn't be put in positions where they're checked up on. My shot at a golden rule is that the other big characteristic of things which are frauds is that they grow. Compound interest is the friend of the investor, but it's the enemy of a fraudster, because a fraudster not only has to cover up his responsibility for the crime, he has to cover up the existence of the crime itself. And since that happens, when there's a gap between the official books and the real books, it will tend to grow. That's the tell that they have. So my rule would be, if you see something that's growing at an unusual rate, it needs to be checked out. And it needs to be checked out in a way that it hasn't been checked out before, because if it's a fraud, it will have been designed around all the normal ways that you have of checking up on a fraud.
Taking a step back, so on the horizon, Brexit. Mm. We have a complete change, potentially, of market rules, of the regulations that will govern a whole range of industries, but also the regulators themselves are going to be completely new and redesigned. This feels to me like good opportunity for some clever frauds.
Well, stock promotion, stock exchange fraud, it's a choice variable. You can choose how much of it you want to have. And you can choose it by simply making it more or less difficult to get listed in the amount of audited accounts and due diligence you have to require. If we want, post-Brexit, we can depart from European standards, which we actually designed in the first place, but there you go, and we can make a choice either to be the scam capital of Europe, which...
Someone's got to be.
Without wanting to disparage your fine markets, there's plenty of investors in AIM stocks who would say that we already are. Or we can decide to go the other way and be the market in Europe where you can be 100% guaranteed you're not investing in a fraud, albeit that that means we'll have fewer companies. It's a marketing decision in many ways. I'm not sure what the profit-maximising version of that is. All I do know is that if you had a rule in the technology sector that you were not going to invest in anyone who told a lie or faked a demo, you would have kept out of big scams like Theranos, which is currently in the news, But you would also have missed both Oracle and Apple, because both Larry Ellison and Steve Jobs fake demos all the time.
Yeah, you can't win.
Yeah. Well, you can win, but not without taking risk of being taken for all your money.
With that in mind, that not even considering the choice element, it feels like a lot of the potential for scams and for frauds is when, you know, the rules are still being made, when they're still being developed, is so much of this is reactionary.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. You know, fraud and fraud protection progresses one disaster at a time. I mean, at the moment, I would guess that you are quite safe compared to most of history from stock exchange fraud, simply because I don't understand why, in a market where you can do a Bitcoin initial coin offering for $200 million with no regulation at all, I can't notice anyone who bothers floating a fraudulent company on the stock exchange as a fool. You know, they're leaving money on the table. And at some point, that market will have its own wake-up moments where it realises that you can scam people, but you can't scam them again and again in the exact same way. So if you're going to keep on being a viable market, then you're going to have to build some protection into the system. But yeah, and it's absolutely true. When you've got a new market, particularly one in which you've got ambitious market share growth, everyone dials back their standards. Those are the sorts of things that people look for. And it can be as simple as if you've got an electric goods manufacturer that wants to grow their market share, they're going to get lots of people taking advantage of their generous payment terms. And some of them will be old-fashioned Craig Twins, Ronnie and Reggie style long firms. It's exactly that. When you've got new people and ambitious growth targets, that's when it all starts.
You mentioned the Cray twins. In your book, the quotes from their bookkeeper, Leslie Payne, that everyone had at least one long firm in them, you know, a kind of fraud. Do you reckon that is true?
It's totally true. I also read a book by a professor of criminology who checked that out with people at Scotland Yard. If you've not got previous convictions and you want to do a long firm scam, everyone gets one free shot at it. And you just say it was a terribly unfortunate occurrence. Your business had to cease trading. You had overextended yourself. As long as you don't show up with the money actually still in your bank accounts, obviously. But everyone gets a free shot. I've considered it myself. But the fact is that since it's not moved beyond the pipe dream stage for the last 10 years for me, since I've first found out about that quote, I guess that I've still got enough of a psychological defence mechanism against turning into a criminal.
We'll invite you back in 10 years' time to see what's happened. There was actually, you know, throughout the book, they're good anecdotes. You've got, a sort of hunger there for the sort of the colourful details of the anecdotes there. I'm not going to spoil anything because I want people to read the book, but do you have a favourite?
My absolute favourite is Artur Alves Reis, who was a Portuguese guy in the 1920s who decided that forging banknotes was good, but that what would be really cool would be to forge a letter from the governor of the Bank of Portugal and take it to the official printers of Portuguese banknotes, saying that he'd been asked by the governor of the Bank of Portugal to just print off $1 million worth of escudos for no particular reason. And they did it, leaving him in possession of what was at the time a huge sum of money that was completely indistinguishable from genuine banknotes because they were genuine. Unfortunately, he ended up spending it all a bit too quickly, causing a mini boom and bust in the country of Portugal. And, well, it all had a quite sad ending, really, because they completely destroyed confidence in the currency. There was a recession, a military coup, and Portugal ended up as a dictatorship for the next 50 years. But in his time, although his consequences were disastrous, the guy had ambition. He went for the brass ring.
Indeed, why go small when... Dan, very much appreciate you coming in and chatting to me. Looking at the economy, looking at the world, I mean, do you think that this is something, have we passed from a kind of golden age of fraud? Are we getting better or worse?
It goes in cycles, basically, because, and frauds come along once every business cycle. Not so much because people only try to commit them once every business cycle, but once growth slows, all of the frauds of the previous 5 or 6 years tend to come out into the open. The economist J.K. Galbraith coined the phrase the bezel, being that part of GDP which is actually fictitious because it's the result of frauds that have been committed but not yet discovered. And during that wonderful period, the fraudster has the use of the money, whereas the victim doesn't know he's lost it yet, and everyone feels a little bit richer than they actually were. We had a big clearing out between 2008 and 2010 in the financial system. Most of Europe had another big clearing out over the last 5 years. We're probably at a low point in the cycle right now, but that's, you know, there's never been a better time to get in on the ground floor, I suppose.
And finally then, you mentioned obviously that you had been, you know, in a front row seat for a lot of this. Mm. Any regrets in terms of the things that you missed or could have said?
I wish I had been nastier about PPI. I was quite nasty about it, but only in the context of an extremely boring debate about insurance premium accounting that I believe absolutely no one read. I'm quite happy that I, about the fight I picked with UBS over the tax avoidance scandal. LIBOR, I think, though, has to be the real regret. Everyone saw that coming as early as 2007, 2008. Everyone knew it was a bit dodgy, but no one realised that what we were actually seeing here was something we should have been considering as criminal. And I think that was one of the things that made me really want to write the book, that it absolutely astounded me that I could be aware of all of the facts, but that someone in the streets who just said, they're all crooks, aren't they, actually understood the whole thing better than a lot of us who knew all the details.